I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody. I'm Scott Johnson, and this is Current Geek, and I'm happy to tell you about Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frogpants All-Stars, Geeks of the World, and you to keep you current on all things that matter most. That gavel-wielding genius is Tom Merritt, everybody. Tom Merritt, hello.
It only took 93 episodes for you to finally stumble over the intro.
Completely Scott. Jacked it up. What
I'm
going to
go
do?
Pull down our 93 days since the last accident sign on our construction site. I'm excited. It's Friday. It's Current Geek. That means the weekend's coming.
Yep.
My friend Roger Chang's coming into town. We're going to tool around Los Angeles a little bit. Perfect way to kick it off.
No, it's great. And then next week, a week from today, you'll be waking up in my home. Well, not right now. This morning you would have been a week
from
today.
Second, I thought you were going to say bed.
No. You know, we're going to be, that's never an option. But you being here in Salt Lake City is an option. He's here to see the Warcraft movie next weekend with a bunch of fans and friends. And I'm super jazzed and excited about that. And maybe a little special Current Geek as well. So come on back for that.
Look forward to that.
We have guests today, and we're going to start with one who I knew from many moons ago. Well, not many moons ago, but he performed live at Nerdtacular 2012 and 13. Right? 13. Do I have that right, John?
It was two in a row. I think it was 12 and 13, or what was the last?
Because you did the one in town, and then we did the one up at Snowbird, and the one up at Snowbird was your last one, right?
Yeah, that was the last one.
2013, man. That feels like yesterday. John Anilio on the phone with us. How's it going, man?
It's great. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here. I'm a weekly listener of Current Geek, so like I'm psyched.
Are you excited? You don't have to listen to this one though, you know. You can just avoid it. Just like
I'm narcissistic enough to like want to hear my own voice again. So I'll listen to it anyway.
Also joining us, we have Patrick Hessler. He works with you and does podcasts with you, and a musician in his own right. And he has a couple of sonic screwdrivers with him. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you, man. You're both in for a treat because it's Current Geek, and it's a treat every single week. And it begins with these headlines.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Thomas?
Well, we start with British businessman Graham Jules, who just wanted to publish a book and trademark its title, which you can't really copyright titles, but you can trademark them so that you can sell ancillary merchandise. His book was called Business Zero to Superhero. Back in 2014, he was about to put it out, and Marvel and DC both objected because they jointly own the trademark on the word superhero. 4 days before a planned hearing at the Intellectual Property Office in London, both comic companies dropped the case. Jules says he spent a total of £200 and spent 200 hours writing letters to defend himself. He never hired a lawyer.
I kind of like the idea that Marvel and DC dropped the suit because there's something noble about the idea of not pressing on something kind of that silly, in my opinion. Like, that shouldn't...
I mean, if they never pressed in the first place, maybe, but they, like, did this for years before they finally just backed off at the last minute. It's almost a worse dick move.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. It took them too long. But I guess I was going to ask this question, and everyone feel free to chime in on this, but... If I'm at IDW Comics or some other comics publishing company, Dark Horse or somebody, and I refer to my characters as a superhero, am I in trouble with the big two? It sounds like I might be.
Yes, you are. And that's why they don't use that.
Really?
Yeah, go look.
So is it kind of like how Marvel can't use the term, and part of their contract with Sony, or not Sony, with Fox, is they can't use the term mutant, right? In any of the Marvel cinematic movies. Because Fox has some deal where they're the only ones that get to say the word mutant in their movies. Is it the kind of same thing?
It's a licensing agreement. But also, that's why Marvel has Captain Marvel, and DC has to call their guy Shazam, because they left Shazam out of print too long as Captain Marvel.
Wow. Speaking of that, though, there's some confusion. There was news this week about some possible casting rumors for Captain Marvel and who we might get in there. And
Carol Danvers cast him Captain Marvel, not Shazam.
Yes.
Well, more specifically, Brie Larson in the live action adaptation. But there have been some confusion about what they're talking about. Like, a lot of people I talk to who are not necessarily hardcore comic fans are like, Wayne, isn't that the guy, like, some people are like, isn't that the guy with the Winnebago in the 70s that would, like, turn
Billy
into
Batson.
Himself? Yeah. And I don't know what to say to these people. I feel like saying, well, thanks to some comic book chicanery, there's, you know, it's a little confusing at this point.
That's correct.
Yep.
Yeah, I think Marvel and DC are fairly litigious about that kind of thing. We had a we interview a lot of authors and editors on Functional Nerds, and we had Lou Anders, who had a short story collection of a bunch of different authors. And I think the initial, and it was all superhero kind of themed stories. And I believe the initial title of it was like With Great Responsibility or yep. With Great Power. I guess it was With Great Power. And Marvel was like, no. So he had a chance. I forget what he ended up calling it in the end. But yeah, they watch that stuff pretty strongly. They think you're making money on their sort of copyrighted things, then they're going to come for you. But you would think superhero at this point is, it's just in the public consciousness so much.
Well, okay. And I think this is important to point out, because we've been a little loose here in our discussion calling it copyright.
Right.
If it were copyright, that would be a different thing. It's a trademark.
It's trademark.
Trademarks don't expire, because a trademark is, you know, I'm Merit Baked Goods, and that's going to be my trademark and my children's trademark. And like, it can't expire because it's the name I'm protecting, because I don't want somebody else to use it. Mm-hmm. So it's not that they're copyrighting superhero and saying no one else can use the word superhero. They're saying, if you publish a comic book, we've trademarked the name superhero so that no one else can put out superhero comics under that name. And I think the argument that this businessman was going to make is, that's a generic word now. Like, you could trademark Superman the superhero, but I don't think that they should be granted a trademark for superhero because it's been genericized. That would have been an interesting test case. I think he would have lost. So I'm actually curious why DC and Marvel backed off.
Well
if you go down the road, so I live in Denver. Denver is the Mile High City. And one of the trademark things here is 5280. Mm. There's a magazine that has trademarked 5280 magazine. And they've also trademarked 5280 real estate, 5280 restaurant, anything that has to do with what their magazine talks about. And if you try to start a business that uses any of those trademarks, they go after you. But if you try to start like 5280 Auto Garage, they don't care.
Well, not only do they don't care, but there's no legal precedence for them to fight something like that. And that's what this guy was saying, I guess. So maybe what Marvel and DC were doing is they're just saying, all right, we're going to be hardcore, and this is a book, and I know it's supposed to be comic books technically, but it's still a book, so we'll push it as long as we can, and then, you know, at the last minute, we'll pull out. So Tom's right. At the end of all this, it feels like kind of a dick move by those publishers. I take it all back. I was going to say it was a nice thing, but no, you guys are jerks.
All right. Let's move on to a nice thing. A volunteer of the National Museum of Computing at Bletchley Park, the famous place where Alan Turing and friends cracked the Enigma machine. The people who are volunteering there now saw a photograph on eBay of a telegram machine for sale for £9.50. John Wetter, who's one of the volunteers, said he went to Southend to investigate in person, found a keyboard in its original case on the floor of a shed, paid £10, told the seller, keep the change, and came back with what turned out to be part of a Lorenz machine, which was a bigger, more advanced encryption machine than Enigma, used by Germany to send secret messages in World War II. They'll combine the keyboard with a machine on loan from Norway to be able to demonstrate breaking the code, because now they have a keyboard to go with it. The only part they're missing is a motor to make it actually run on its own.
Oh, I love stuff like this, like just showing up at a garage sale and finding some ancient thing. I always hope for that. Every Saturday I'll see a garage sale. I think I should stop there. Maybe that guy's got, I don't know, Hitler's mustache in a case or something, and he just thinks
Amazing Fantasy 16.
Yeah. Like, I love the idea of just running into this stuff, so I guess good on them. This one that's on loan from Norway is an actual same device, right? They're just
it's the rest of the machine. Like, what they found in the shed was just the keyboard for entering the equipment, and then the actual machine that did all the encrypting and everything is what they've got on loan from Norway.
I just watched Citizen 4 on HBO yesterday. Probably shouldn't have watched that before we talk about encryption and stuff, because now I'm paranoid. That documentary made me paranoid. Has anyone seen that? The Edward Snowden thing? I don't know.
No, Scott. I wouldn't dare watch that and be a traitor to my country.
There is a giant NSA data center like 20 minutes that way from me. It's in the movie even, and it completely freaks me out now because of that documentary. I should have watched, I don't know, Silicon Valley or freaking Veep instead. What was I thinking?
I, for one, welcome my robot overlords.
Well, they've got a lot of info on you.
Yeah, but I have an iPhone. Yeah, they have to pay someone like $1 million to crack it.
Well, if you believe the claims in that documentary, they have more access to that stuff than any of us are being told. And
the FBI had to pay because the FBI is underfunded. The NSA, on the other hand.
Yeah, it's funny because the documentary actually made me think of FBI agents as kind of disheveled guys with like older suits who couldn't find the keys to his car. Like,
one more thing.
Yeah, made him just seem like they were like the schlubs or the gumshoes of the government, and they made the NSA seem like evil aliens from, you know, some planet outside of our solar system. It was really odd. Not to take things completely away from the decryption device from Germany, but it was on my mind and I couldn't help it.
Well, let's shift gears to video games, free video games, free DRM free video games. GOG, we call them good old games, has launched GOG Connect that allows users to add certain DRM free versions of Steam games to your GOG library at no extra cost. All you have to do is install the GOG Connect software, connect that to your Steam account, and it'll let you know what games it can transfer and then do the transfer for you. Currently, only around 20 games qualify, so you're not going to bring over your entire Steam library unless your entire Steam library is exactly these 20 games. But it's a cool thing where GOG is saying, well, it's DRM free. We'll register it with our library. That's fine. Why not? That'll get people to use GOG more often.
That's the theory. I mean, it's weird that my relationship with good old games is, I don't know, it's a little odd. I buy most of what I play and get most of what I play, whether it's free or for cost, on Steam. And occasionally what will happen is you'll find out some crazy deal on good old games. Like, you can get The Witcher 3 over here for half off, which partly might be because good old games is owned or co-owned, or they're all connected somehow with CD Projekt over there in Poland, and they're the company that developed the Witcher series. So a lot of times the big deals are on their own games. It's like Valve, and they have, you know, they have Half-Life and Portal and all these games. You know, they have the Witcher series and a few others. So it's kind of that same arrangement. But what I end up doing is just getting great sales over there when it makes sense, but primarily staying over in the side of things with Steam. Do you guys do any different? How about you, Patrick?
I limit how many games I play simply because I have so much work to do and I'm trying to publish books. I've got one coming out from WordFire. And if I start playing games like World of Warcraft, I get sucked in and I don't stop.
Yeah, you're a wise man. It's the right thing to do. John, how are you with your gaming habits these days?
I don't really game much. I'm sort of in the same boat.
That's not true. You have a Wii.
I have a Wii. We've been playing a lot of Mario Kart lately, and my son. So yeah, I'm sorry, I spoke out of turn. I've played every version of Skylanders over the past 5 years, so I could tell you a lot about that. But
we're working on a plan to talk his wife into a PS4.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. The old Wii does not. You can't do much with that these days because I'm like, ooh, that Star Wars game is out. Maybe I'll get that. Oh, you can't do that.
Think of this, and this sounds crazy to say it out loud, but in November, it will be a 10-year anniversary for that device. So hang on to that thing. The Wii is 10 years old.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I remember when, like, all the hoopla when that first came out. We just got ours like 3 or 4 years ago. Do they even sell like the original Wii still?
I think you can get them used. They certainly don't manufacture them. You might get lucky once in a while, find a Walmart with old stock or something. But 10 years is a long time. The interesting thing about this situation with good old games is this, for me anyway. The PC gaming space is really interesting because Steam is so dominant and they have such a stranglehold on the hearts and minds of gamers, and they've earned it. They've worked really hard for that. They are reliable and respectable, and they do what they kind of say they're going to do. They had some rough early goings on, but then again, they were breaking new ground. Nobody had really done this before. So there's a lot of loyalty there that's difficult for people to sort of break away from outside of a few outliers. So when other services come along, And they either do it because, like, good old games, their whole premise in the beginning was, well, we have these really old games, like early 90s RPGs you can't get anywhere else anymore, and they'll run on your modern PC, and that was kind of their big selling point. And since then, they've advanced that into, you know, more current releases and things, but still there's a big focus of on good old games, which was part of their name. And then you have other services like Green Man Gaming and others that come along and compete on price. But I think the large part of the market still leans real heavily back into Steam and just sort of stays there. That's where their stuff is. It's where their friends are. It's where their friends' lists are. So I don't know that this will do much in the end, that this will actually drive too many people to put much of what they have on Steam, DRM free or not, over on good old games. You'd have to be somebody who is feeling rebellious against Valve and against Steam anyway to probably make that move.
See, and I'm such a nerd, though. I prefer the old classic arcade games.
Mm.
Which you can play a lot of those online now.
Yeah, like, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's how good old games got started, was taking old games and making them available again.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Like Galaga.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Listen, the quarters I put into Galaga would make my mother blush at this point.
Yeah. We have a Dave and Buster's here. They have a Galaga. That's like the only reason to go there.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? The only reason for me to go to Denver is to go to Dave and Buster's. Like, I hate that we don't have something like that here anymore, and you guys are the only ones that have it.
You're not coming to Denver Comic Con?
No. Maybe. I don't know. It's a 10-hour drive. Should I? Maybe. I don't
yes.
know.
All right. Yes. I'm going to be there. Come
right.
on.
It's only an hour straight and then 9 hours up, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not so bad. I could probably swing it. We'll see.
Hey, last month EVE Online released an update including something called Citadels that can be built to defend space. In fact, that was the name of the update. The notorious Hard Knocks Inc., the first they're notorious because they're just full of thieves and they're proud of it. They built the first Fortizar class large citadel, then became the first to blow up someone else's. Then they announced the building of the first 800,000 square meter Keepstar class extra large citadel, which is the biggest structure in all of EVE Online at this time. Its doomsday weapon can bounce between ships, destroying an entire armada with one shot. The estimated value of the Keepstar structure in ISK, if you translate ISK into real dollars, which you can do because you can pay for your subscription with ISK, the actual value of the Keepstar structure is $15,000.
Yeah, 15 grand in real money for a big fake pixel device.
I am blown away by this story, Tom. I didn't know people still played EVE Online.
They do. They have a very dedicated, rabid fan base that are very, very into that thing. Their community is hot and strong since 2003, and so I'm not surprised. Every time I hear a news article about EVE, I'm never surprised that it's full of intrigue, that there's lots of weird backstabby political stuff going on. Like, it is one of the strangest microcosms of kind of human behavior that the gaming world, maybe any other part of this world, has. And it's this concentrated soup of, like, I just want to be a pirate, space pirate that goes around and, you know, smuggles stuff, or I want to be a leader of a giant corporation with the biggest citadel in the universe and blow stuff up with one shot. And everything in between. Like, for me, the gameplay is a little bit too much like doing math, but but people who are into it, man, they are way into it. So yeah, EVE's got nothing to worry about, and they're branching out into other things. They have another game on the way. Like, they're doing just fine. I think they're still like the biggest money making company or something close to that in Iceland. They're like huge over there. They're like a national treasure.
Yeah, this story just reminded me of like Ready Player One. I'm like, oh, this is the whole, like, oh wait, I think Oasis was the name of the game in the world. Oasis. Ready Player One, and I'm like, wow, that really goes on in real life. That's crazy.
It really does, and in a way, it's almost like, I mean, the only difference is they're not wearing VR helmets to, like, exist in the world. They're, you know, in space with keyboards and mice, flying their ships around, and it's a beautiful game. It's very immersive and all that stuff, but the mind games and just the like the spies and the people who topple it, you know, these huge corporations through espionage and stuff, is just, it's some of it's kind of heartbreaking. You hear about people lose actual money, like a couple of grand worth of stuff they spent on, you know, whoever figures out a way to take down these guys, which may never happen. I mean, they really are like the, I don't know what they are. What's the equivalent in like modern science fiction? I can't think of who's this big, but that's huge. It's like the Empire with no rebellion. So, yeah, it's really interesting. I love that stuff.
Well, and the thing is, they don't have anything to defend in their space. And I'm not an EVE Online player, so if I speak out of turn, that please forgive me. But from what I read, their system is barren because they've just mined it all to death or harvested all the resources. Also, they're just there to steal from other people, so they don't need to grow anything. So they have this huge citadel to just defend basically barren planets.
Yep. We still have in our the Frog Pants community, we have a group who plays in there, an AIE group, and they are really, really into this game. But my guess is if they wandered anywhere near their space, the Notorious Hard Knocks Inc. group, they would be destroyed immediately. So just be careful, everyone.
Yeah, be careful out there.
Yeah.
This is amazing. The Pong Project has built a physical version of Pong. So it's a table. It's a coffee table Pong game with physical paddles, a physical dot, everything controlled by a computer. So you're playing Pong, but your display are actually analog things that are moving around. Movements are translated by servos and magnets. There are even LEDs for displaying the score, and it's coin operated to start a game.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh, yeah. I want one. I want one so bad.
Yeah, everyone needs to go watch that video that you guys linked to in the show, because I'm amazed that anybody that can build anything with their hands, because I can't do any, like my dad's an electrician and he just builds stuff all the time, and that gene did not get passed on to me at all. I can't make anything. So to see the amount of time and dedication and skill that those guys had to put in to make, I don't know how long it took them to make it. I'm assuming months and months and months. I mean, it was, and it looks amazing. And it looks a lot like air hockey almost. I mean, that's sort of the gameplay, but it's amazing.
Yeah. Have you
seen the table that, pen and paper role players use, where they basically put a touchscreen TV in the table and they use it to show the maps and stuff when they're playing?
Oh, sure.
This seems like a trend that people are doing now. They're like building these interactive tables to play games
on. I'm all in on this idea. Like, I'm glad you brought that up, because the idea of taking like a, I don't know, a Dungeons and Dragons kind of scenario.
Exactly.
You would normally have to put on graph paper or build, you know, expensive miniature sets or whatever. And there's an art to that. And I don't want to, I'm not, you know, saying that shouldn't continue on because it's super cool. But just imagine the kind of time you'd cut down. And you could create really complex scenarios that would change all the time and essentially bring half of the video game part of D&D over to the tabletop origins. Not too much of it. You know, you still want the we're all here together. You still want your guy running it. You still want to have that kind of communal experience that very few other things provide. But to be able to do that in this kind of half measure way, it would be really cool. And like those Microsoft Surface tables, I kept thinking that's your ultimate use case for these. Every time they'd show them, it'd be like, oh, this is for ordering drinks at a bar, or this is for ordering food at a restaurant. And I'd think, no, this is for telling your cleric that you need healing. That's what this is for.
Imagine going to Red Robin and that little kiosk thing that they put on the table. You're using that to play games.
That's right.
Wait, they do that now.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Do they really? They charge you, though.
Oh.
Yeah, they do. Well, they don't charge me.
It is kind of funny to think, like, Ms. Pac-Man tabletop and all of that.
I loved
meant
that.
To replace, like, hey, we don't have to build things anymore. We don't have to have pool tables. You could just sit and play a video game and the computer takes care of displaying everything. And we've gone back to, like, you know what would be cool is if these were actually physical objects.
Yeah.
Again.
The tabletop Ms. Pac-Man was my favorite. It was, my mom was a bartender. She had that in her bar. And I used to go there every day after school and just feed quarters into that beast and sit there and play that game.
Yeah,
I have one in the when Tom's here, I get to see it. It doesn't actually run, but I have one of those cocktail models in the back corner of my studio over here, and I will never let it go. It's going to be a curse on my life because it's huge, heavy, and a pain in the butt, and impossible to find parts for. I may gut it, make a main machine. Regardless of all of that, I will never ever let it go.
Yeah, they're gorgeous too. Yeah.
Yeah.
On stage at MegaCon this week, Haley Atwell was asked if she would be up for a third season of Agent Carter should Netflix want to bring it back. Netflix hasn't said anything about this, by the way, but it's now the classic response when ABC cancels a show or any other big network cancels a show, like, maybe Netflix will bring it back. Atwell said, yeah, she'd shoot on weekends to do it. Quote, there was talk of season 3 of going further back into her past. So the showrunners were talking about a possible kind of twist, I suppose, into something to do with the family. They suggested there would be more to do with my brother.
Oh, man. Now, see, this is making it worse. As happy as I am to hear her say that, because if it did go through, obviously she's on board. But what a bummer, because I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're screwed. But it's cool to know that, you know, she's into it. And now she's given us, like, more stuff to wish we saw and we may never see. But I still say there's no reason not to strike some deal. I mean, Netflix already doing a great job with Marvel properties. Why not carry that one over? There's enough fans.
Well, and Haley may be willing to work on weekends, but will the rest of the cast and crew?
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. I'm like, yeah, you got to pay all those guys, time and a half or double time on the weekends. You know, the lighting guys and sound guys and everything else. Maybe they don't want to work on the weekend, I'm sure.
Yeah. What's the other show, Tom? She's doing some other show that's...
I can never remember the name of it, and I didn't write it down this time. But it's an ABC show, yeah. And by all accounts, it's supposed to be good. Mm. She's locked up with ABC. Also, it's called Conviction. Mm. I imagine that ABC probably has a way to at least impede Netflix from picking up Agent Carter, because it is paired up with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and tied into the movies in a way that the Netflix Defenders group is not.
Yeah, good point. I'd be fine with it. So bring it back. Yeah. I say all this knowing I've only seen a couple of episodes and loved what I saw. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm some kind of diehard fan that never missed an episode, because I'm way behind. But bring it to Netflix so that I'll know that it'll always be there, and then I'll put that off for a long time as well.
What if you made it sweeter, though? What if it was Haley Atwell and Nathan Fillion together?
Well, he's not doing his other thing anymore, right?
Right, that's why they keep saying, now that he's not doing Castle, he could do a Firefly thing on Netflix.
Oh, my Lord. Please let it happen somehow.
Is Marina Baccarin out of whatever she'd been doing most recently? I think so.
Is she? She was doing Homeland. Yeah. I think she's done with that. Who else is? Well, we don't need Alan Tudyk. He's done. I'm not telling you why.
Spoilers.
Zoe's on Suits.
Hell's Suits? What's Suits?
It's on USA Network.
Oh.
Oh, Marina Baccarin's on Gotham.
Oh. Well, they can borrow. She can quit that.
They can all work on the weekends.
Yeah, they only need Netflix. Her once in a while. Seriously, once in a while you need her. You don't even need her for every episode. Have her off being busy running a whole planet full of companions. Let her be the companion lord, and she only has to show up once in a while and tell Matt.
I didn't realize she is the voice of Gideon on The Flash.
Oh, that's cool.
Who does the voice of that?
Marina Baccarin.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Well,
it's been a while since we've heard that voice.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah, I don't think we heard it much, if at all, this past season.
She was on V.
Is it the same? I'm sorry, Scott.
No, I was just going to say, you know that V remake they did? The little V reboot? Yep. She was in that for about a hot minute until that show got canceled.
Well, she was in it as long as it lasted. Yeah. Exactly.
Which was a hot minute, yeah. Yeah. No, but the Gideon, there's also a Gideon on Legends of Tomorrow.
That's a different voice.
It's a different voice, okay.
Yeah, different actor.
Okay.
All right. Time for Reshoot Gate. Star Wars Rogue One is regrouping in June for reshooting, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Supposedly, studio execs felt the tone was off with what a classic Star Wars movie should feel like. They said it was too much of a war movie. They wanted a war movie, but not so much war. I don't know. Anyway, reshoots will attempt to lighten the mood, bring in more fun and adventure. Supposedly, it's meant to lead up to about 10 minutes before Star Wars Begins, or what they now call A New Hope. Of course, reshoots could also allow an appearance by Alden Ehrenreich, who has newly been cast as Han Solo since the finishing of principal photography in February. And then Entertainment Weekly, right before the show, put out a report saying that Jason Bourne series veteran Tony Gilroy has been brought on board to give notes on the first cut and write some new material in addition to what Chris Weitz had written.
So is so what I heard, and I don't know if any of this is, you know, real, but I heard that the problems were that the test audiences or people that were seeing the original cuts were worried it was too dark.
That's all been denied. They're like, no, we haven't even tested it. Like, whoever said test audiences were involved is lying because we haven't tested it.
Okay, so this is just them, internal production, going, yeah, we're not happy with the results, or Suits are like, wait, something's wrong, or whatever.
Reshoots are always scheduled. Every big budget movie has reshoots naturally scheduled. So this could just be the fact that it's Star Wars making people go, wait, this is how movies work? Like, this could be nothing unusual.
Well, the number I keep seeing was 40% of the movie being reshoot.
Yeah, that's been denied, too.
That has, like, as
no,
well?
No, it's not. The studio said, we are not reshooting 40% of the
movie. Then this is probably a know-nothing, then. Like it's probably just, like, everyone freaking out because it's Star, like you said, because it's Star Wars and it's probably fine. Everyone reshoots everything. I remember hearing about Lord of the Rings actors going back to New Zealand for 3 months because they had to fix a bunch of stuff. I mean, we were okay with that, weren't we? Like, you're not going to write a book and your first draft get published. You're going to edit it and tweak it and change it and remove a chapter and add another one. And that's how this stuff
spoilers.
Gets done.
Oh.
Well, you know, when I heard the story after I'd read a couple of the different articles about it, to me, I found it reassuring because the criticism that I have of the prequels, the one that I think a lot of people have, is that no one was keeping George Lucas in check. I mean, if you watch some of the behind the scenes, like DVD stuff, you just see like this room full of yes men that are like, yeah, great idea, boss. Oh, boss, man, that's great, boss. Boss, that's, you know, so
Misa loved that idea.
Yeah. So to me, like, this is people, you know, whoever the higher ups and whatever, they're going to get it as good as they can get it. And you need, you know, multiple, you know, points of view. Sometimes, yeah, I mean, sometimes it could screw it up too. But I think ultimately it's we're going to get a better movie because of this. And like everyone else said, I think it's just normal part of the procedure now. You know,
I'm confused by the whole thing, though. I'm seriously confused. I mean, they didn't say anything about Ben Affleck coming in and being executive producer.
Right?
Yeah.
None of this could be true.
Yeah. This all must be.
Is he going to direct it now? I mean, what's going on?
You know what? Hey, why not? I don't know that I would exactly deny that. He's a fine director. Everyone, he's okay. He's no, you know, he's no.
Han Solo versus Lando.
Oh, man.
Shades of Darkness, Rogue One.
It's a terrible idea.
I'm sorry, but as an actor, he's ruined everything he's ever touched, including Jennifer Gardner.
Oh, zing, zing, ring a ding, ding. Good one there. All right, well that ends your that ends your news for the day. Thank you for that, and all our submitters. Tom, who committed this week to send us rad stories?
Oh man, Strike It Rich One, Captain Kipper, another Jay Martin, Hometown Rival, I Am Sci-Fi, and Surprise Truck. Which I always need to read. Surprise truck!
Yep. I'm surprised.
All submitted things at our subreddit at currentgeek.reddit.com. So please, even if we have a week off like we did last week, we love having people going in there and submitting things and voting on them because it just keeps the party going.
I agree. Quick note here that you can support the show. This is how we keep it running, by going to frogpants.cratejoy.com and picking up our monthly crate. It includes art and drawings and stuff from Tom and books and stickers and stuff. People got shot glasses a couple of months ago.
Nice.
More recent one, they all got calendars. Like, it's always something new, always something cool. If you've heard of these, like, you know, geek crate type boxes that you get every month, well, that's what we're making just for Current Geek listeners. You can find details over at frogpants.cratejoy.com. Check it out today. All right.
It's the only way we support the show. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want us to eat, don't buy one.
Yeah, if you want us to starve and suffer. Do I have flies in my face for this little close-up? All right, great.
America scores and wins.
All right. Look at this, everybody. It's time for the pop quiz. That's where we ask our guests' questions and areas of their expertise. They both happen to be fans of certain things, and we're going to ask them about those. They answer them to the best of their ability, and when they get an answer right, you'll hear this. When you get it wrong, you'll hear this. Tom will keep score the entire time. Compare them. Let the competition begin. Patrick, I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
Are you ready for your questions?
Not even a little bit.
All right. Here's your topic. It is Star Trek trivia from the original series or TNG, a little mix of both. All right. So here goes. First question. What class of starship is the Enterprise D? The Enterprise D.
Galaxy class.
You are correct. Nicely done. In the TOS episode, do the space hippies on board... Hold on. In the TOS episode, space hippies come aboard the Enterprise and have a sick jam session. What is the song?
Oh, gosh.
I can almost hear it.
I can, too. Yeah. I don't have it.
It has the word man in it.
It does have man in it. In the song. Yeah, I don't know about the title. But anyway, well, I'll tell you. It is The Way to Eden. The Way to Eden. It's horrible. It's real
Sing
bad.
It with me.
It's and, so bad.
I remember those people. Oh, my gosh.
Patrick gets a bonus point for not remembering that horrible song.
Well, yes. Well done. See, I told you. Okay, next up. What game does Picard play with some Nausicaans in his Starfleet Academy days? And you remember they were begging
Quidditch.
Him
to...
Sabacc.
You are incorrect. It is Domjot. You play Domjot. Remember that?
Oh, gosh.
Play
yeah.
Domjot. Yeah, they're the ones that broke his arm or tore it off or hurt his heart or did something, whatever it was.
You play Domjot.
Spoiler. Okay, next question. In the TOS episode Spectre of the Gun, so Spectre of the Gun is the full title, the crew goes on an Old West planet. What crew member is the only one to have a gun belt with two holsters?
Wow.
Yeah. That is damned specific.
I'm just going ahead and giving him a point for that hard question.
Another way to get it right. Yeah. I'm going to say Spock.
All right. Is it Spock? Incorrect. It is Chekhov is correct.
Chekhov.
Well, of course. Chekhov's guns.
Yeah, see?
I just played an episode of Babylon 5 for somebody with Walter Koenig in it, and they go, whoa, his accent's so weird. I'm like, no, that's his voice.
That's just him talking. How he talks. Yeah, that's just him talking, man. Oh, Babylon 5's so good. All right, next question. In the TNG episode True Q, Q turns Crusher into a dog. What kind of dog does he turn her into? I actually know this. I don't know why I know this, but what kind of dog?
Golden
what,
Retriever.
What breed? Oh, you say Golden Retriever, do you? Let's find out. Incorrect. It is an Irish Setter. Chai. All right. Next question. What TNG episode do the Packlids need help to make their ship go? Make it go.
You actually need the episode title?
Yeah. I don't write these, by the way. We have someone
I'm
else
I'm going to go
these.
With Lost in Space.
Lost in Space. Incorrect. It is Samaritan Snare, which is careful when crossing the street. All right.
You lose a quarter point for throwing out competing titles.
All right, next question. Second to last question. What card game does Kirk demonstrate to some mobsters in an episode called A Piece of the Action? I'll give you a hint. It is a fake game. And it's a stupid name, but it's memorable.
I honestly have no clue. I'm gonna go with Magic the Gathering.
Incorrect. It is Fizbin. He makes it up on the fly. It's kind of a weird Shatner moment.
You would have got a bonus point if you'd said Hearthstone.
Sean, there, Tom
you,
showing
you
his...
You have really good researchers.
Yeah, well, he's crazy, really. All right, final question. What animal does Spock nerve pinch the hell out of in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier? That's a classic. It's the best moment in Star Trek.
Pardon me. What does God need with a starship?
It's still a good
bonus
question.
Point for the quote.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go with a. Oh my gosh, I honestly don't remember. I'm gonna go with a. Dog.
A dog. Is it a dog? It is a horse. The answer is
a horse.
Yeah, a horse,
right.
Of course.
Bonus point for that not being the original series or TNG as specified in the introduction to the quiz.
Thank you for that. Well said. All right. Geez, Ice Worm. All right, next one. Next quiz.
Good luck, John.
John, this is,
oh, thanks.
This is
thanks
for
back.
You, brother. Your category is Star Wars and Clone Wars trivia. So Star Wars, man. Clone Wars trivia, rather.
Okay.
Oh, it's just Clone Wars.
Just okay. Clone Wars, sorry. Just yeah. Okay. Originally, I told him that you also like that Rebels thing, and I think he just did Clone Wars. But if there's Rebels stuff in here, don't be surprised.
That's fine.
How many seasons of the Clone Wars are there?
Clone Wars. That's how an Irish setter says it.
Six.
Six, that is correct. Nicely done.
Oh.
There's a ding for you. Yeah. What is the name of the first episode of the first season of Clone Wars?
I'm not going to get episode names at all. I say Spirits.
Ambush. Ambush.
Ambush is the correct answer. Ambush.
Half point for not specifying which Clone Wars... as there are two.
Oh, that's
and
right.
In fact, you could interpret it as three because there was the movie separate from the actual second series.
Ah, that's right. You're that's not wrong right. about that.
You didn't say episode.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I don't know. They call the movies episode one, episode two.
The British call TV shows series instead of seasons. All right, here's your next question. What actor provides the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi in this series?
I don't know. I don't know.
James Arnold Taylor. You know that guy.
He's seen fire. He's seen rain.
That's why he has to have the Arnold so he can people know who he is.
He actually recorded dialogue for Force Awakens that they didn't use because they weren't sure they were going to get Owen.
Ewan McGregor.
So they used him as a backup, and then they never used it.
You know, old Owen McGregor.
Tom loses a point for putting in my head the idea of Owen Wilson as the voice.
I deserve to lose more than one.
All right, next up. What actor took over as the voice of Palpatine/Darth Sidious in the 5th and 6th season of the show?
Is it Ian McDiarmid?
No. No. This completely surprised me. It's Tim Curry.
Curry.
That's crazy.
Well, you should have had the Clone Wars.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I know.
You know. The Emperor is frightening.
All right, next one. Who is Darth Maul's brother in the series?
Oh, Savage Opress.
You are correct.
Did I get that back?
You got it exactly right. Savage Opress. Okay. It's a strange name, though. I think.
Yes.
Savage.
That's right, yeah.
That shows how far behind I am on that thing, because I didn't know he had a brother. Is that like season 5?
Yeah.
I've seen up through 4 or 3 or something. Next question. Who are the Mandalorian splinter group that eventually joins Darth Maul?
Oh, what is that? Oh, I know this.
I want to say there are movies with this title, not related to Star Wars at all, but it's like a very common sort of 70s action revenge movie name.
Yeah. Shaft Amongst the Mandalorians. Great.
Shut
70s
your mouth.
I know it's wrong. I'm going to say the hand.
You are incorrect. I like that, though. Death Watch is the correct answer.
Death Watch. Yeah, I knew that.
Final or second to last question. Who is the sister of the Mandalorian Duchess Satine Kryze?
Satine. Obi-Wan's little love interest.
Yeah, the sister. Oh, man. I don't even remember. I don't know.
Do you have a sister?
It is... It is Bo-Katan Kryze, or Kryze.
Oh, please. I'm giving you a half point because we knew all that stuff about Satine and Obi-Wan.
Yeah, that's impressive. All right, final question. What is the title of the final episode of Star Wars Clone Wars of Season 6?
Is it Spirits?
You are incorrect. It is Sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
You get point one for having the S correct.
Yeah.
I think you were thinking of Last Airbender.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. I'm mixing my...
Mystical Jedi.
I would have said Dark Disciple and then be like, oh, wait, that was only put out as a book.
Yeah, that was a book. A fine book, a Christy Golden book, in fact.
Yeah. She did a great job.
She's really good, all right, so Tom, add them all up. How'd they do?
All right, with a final score of 3.1 is John and 4.75 is Patrick.
Ooh. Wow, Patrick, look at that. Pulled it out, dude. Yeah. Nicely done. I'm very impressed.
Thank you. Is my reward? You're coming to Denver Comic Con?
Yay, Denver Comic Con. Everyone come on out.
We'll all win a Scott Johnson.
It'll be great. Let's get into this now.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right, today's forecast is a little different, by the way. It's also a thing we do every week where we predict the future in technology, entertainment, whatever is on our minds. And we always kind of take turns kind of picking stuff we think might happen. But Tom culled something from news earlier this week that came out of a stage, not presentation, but an interview with Elon Musk at the Code Conference, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Elon Musk said a lot of things at the Code Conference, as he is wont to do. But he said one of these things is that there is a 1 in billions chance we're actually living in reality. And he said Pong proves it. So it's a little callback to our earlier story about the tabletop Pong. He points out that Pong was 40 years ago, and we now, 40 years later, have VR. Here's the quote. If you assume any rate of improvement at all, then the games will become indistinguishable from reality, even if at that rate of advancement drops by 1,000 from what it is now. Then you just say, okay, let's imagine it's 10,000 years in the future, which is nothing on the evolutionary scale. We get games that are indistinguishable from reality, and therefore he says if that's possible, which it is, then it may. And then he goes into the Nick Bostrom calculation, which Nick Bostrom put this out as a possibility in philosophy several years back, that therefore there is a very small chance that we wouldn't be the people in the simulation because you could have so many simulations. What are the chances that you're in the actual reality when there could be billions of simulations running?
Okay, so a lot of the websites that I read boiled it down to this statement that Elon Musk thinks that we might all be living in a video game simulation.
No, he thinks it's likely.
That it's actually likely. That it's not just like, oh, what if? Like, he thinks we might really be there. Now, I just want to say about this, first of all, I love the idea of it. I always have, so it's super cool, intellectual exercise to even talk about it. But secondly, I like all of my rich, inventive, genius businessmen, forward thinkers to be a little bonkers. You know what I mean? Like, that is okay with me. I'm totally cool with it.
If you watch that video, when he says that, because I think he says, like, there's a, you know, well, I love that he referred to it as base reality.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, there's only a billions of a chance that we're actually in base reality. And I think it's Walt Mossberg, and I forget who else is up there, but they just kind of squint their eyes at him like, did he just say the base reality thing? I don't know what he's talking about.
It's awesome because this is the same guy that's like, all right, here is the future of transportation potentially, and here is the future of energy storage and potentially distribution of energy. And it could fundamentally change the world. And, oh, by the way, we may change transportation again because we got this Hyperloop idea. Oh, and by the way, we're trying to go to space and may get to Mars sooner than anyone else, including NASA. Like, all these amazing, earth-shattering, mankind-affecting ideas. And at the same time, he thinks we might be living in a video game. That's amazing. I just freaking love it. I'd love it.
You know why, don't you?
Why?
Because he's one of the video game designers. He's telling his friends, like, watch this. I'll go down and in my avatar, tell them exactly what's going on, and nobody will believe me.
Yeah, it could be.
There's a I'm reading a book currently by Chuck Klosterman, who is one of my favorite nonfiction writers. I have an e-arc of this book, an advanced reader copy of it, and I think it's coming out really soon though, in the next couple of weeks, and it's called "But What If We're Wrong?" And the principle behind it is, you know, in sort of advances of science, every age, the scientists in that age think, yeah, we're right. We got all this. So basically it's like, well, what if we're wrong now? And he talks a lot about that. In one of the chapters, he talks about that Nick Bostrom paper. And there's a good chapter or two on this very topic with Elon Musk. So the book's coming out soon. So it's definitely, if this is like an intriguing concept to people, Klosterman really like breaks it down. He's not a science writer. He's more of like a comedic writer, but he, It's a good read.
What's the title again? What's the title?
I believe it's "But What If We're Wrong."
Okay, all right, yeah.
And it's Chuck Klosterman with a K. It's like Klosterman, I believe.
I like that stuff.
It's good stuff. But yeah, it's I do love it too. Like this, you know, I like sort of theorizing about all this too. But yeah, I like my rich guys crazy too.
But don't you think there is part of what makes them geniuses is that they can think in ways that are non-traditional? Like they can wrap their heads around either problems or solutions or new ideas or whatever in a way that's just, I hate to use the old phrase thinking outside the box, but that's really what they're doing. I mean, they're like going way beyond what we think is possible.
Creativity.
Yeah, it really is. So I am so cool with them having, like, I want Jeff Bezos to have the worst laugh in the history of the world. Like, I want to have, you know, I wanted to have Steve Jobs have the ultimate ego of all time. These are the personality traits of these guys that drove innovation, and it continues with Musk and maybe even mostly with him. Like, he is one of the most interesting dudes ever. And to think it all came from PayPal is the craziest thing still in my head. But anyway, good on him. Maybe we're all in a video game. May we all get the high score and have many lives left.
But here's the question. Are we on Earth 0, Earth 2, or Earth 616?
I don't know.
We're on the 13th floor.
Which is the one where Captain America is not a SHIELD or a Hydra agent? Which one's that?
Hail Hydra.
Okay.
Yeah. If you've never seen the 13th floor, that movie deals with exactly this concept. It's from 1999. It's got Gretchen Mol, Vincent D'Onofrio. Really good.
Oh, why is that familiar?
Gretchen Mol. I don't know.
I must have seen it. I think I have, but now I want to see it again because I don't remember it.
It might be in your Netflix queue and you just haven't watched it yet.
That's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. Maybe Film Sack. We'll see. Great one. Thank you, Elon Musk, for your forecast submission this week to currentgeek@gmail.com. We also get emails at that same self-same address, and I got one here from Karen, who says this: Dear most current of geekers, I like that. Can someone tell me why we take movie critics so seriously? Why are they the final word for so many rather than people finding out what they want to see instead of avoiding what others tell them not to see? I know it's a big questions, that's what it says, but I'm very curious. Audibly yours, Karen. Yeah. Like, this has been on the minds of a lot of people lately. It may even been prompted by the very low Warcraft scores from regular critics and the very high praise from gamers. And maybe that's a perfect example of this. But I talked about it with Terpster this morning. I'm just like, you know what? If you want to go, you should go. If you don't want to see it, you shouldn't see it. But because some guy, some stuffy dude in some New York newspaper told you not to, that shouldn't be your defining reason. Now, if you're a big believer in the averages and you're like, well, if it's got a 60 or higher, that's good enough for me. Maybe that's an okay way to run your life. But maybe you have to be more specific about it and say, well, generally that's true, or that's how I'll feel about rom-coms. But when it comes to Warcraft and my favorite video game of all time, I'm going to not care what critics say because I know what I want to get out of it and just go. Any other thoughts on this whole issue? Karen seems to be flummoxed by it.
Speaking as a person who went to go see not one, but both of the G.I. Joe movies in the theater by myself and enjoyed both of them.
You know what? Hold on a minute. He's right. Those movies are not as bad as everybody thinks they are. They're okay. They're all right. Those G.I. Joe movies.
But John, now you know.
They're okay. They're all right. You know what? I say this. I defend Waterworld until my final breath. I'm going to be on my deathbed at like 85 going, Waterworld was better than you thought, and die.
I say the same thing about the 13th Warrior, and people give me crap all the time.
Well, maybe we're proving the point, you know? Like, Tom likes 10 Speed and Brown Shoe for some reason.
And great series.
Because it's a great series for Tom. And the point is that just love what you love to love and forget about what everyone else thinks. Like, this Warcraft thing or anything else. Like, one of these reviewers really tried a dirty move. He says, it is this generation, which doesn't make sense to me because I feel like it's the same generation, but it's this generation's Battlefield Earth.
I saw that, yeah.
That's so not cool, man. Like, you should
wait, which generation did Battlefield Earth excite?
Exactly, like, my
which
point.
Which generation did it belong to begin with?
Right. Like, I don't know what they mean by that. But
I took my young cousin, he was probably 11 years old, to see Battlefield Earth. He really wanted to see it. He's living in a house with three sisters and a mom. And he's like, I need to do something with a boy. Please, you know, just take me to this movie. I took him to that movie, and he was so angry afterwards. He said, that was horrible.
Yeah. It's a bad movie. It's objectively bad. So I think the whole world agrees about that. I don't know anyone who thinks that that's not true. So
there's somebody. There must be somebody who loves that movie.
John Travolta loves it.
Disagrees with you, and it might be John Travolta.
John Travolta, Barry Pepper.
But here's the point. There are two reasons that critics cause such a fury. Mm. One is we do want recommendations from people we trust before we go to see the movie. There are occasionally movies we're going to see no matter what. Like, Warcraft is one of those for me. Like, I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what Scott says. I'm going to go see that movie because I really want to see that movie. Yep. But a lot of times we want to hear an impartial, like, okay, what is so-and-so? And it used to be in the newspaper days, like, I found the trusted guy whose tastes seem to match mine. When he says he likes it, I know it's good chance I'm going to like it. These days, it's more Rotten Tomatoes. People are like, well, if it's above 70% on Rotten Tomatoes, turns out I usually like those, so I'll go see those. But it's not the be-all, end-all. And then the flip side is the people are like, I liked that movie, and it got 20% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm offended. Or I liked that movie, and the critics said it was bad, and I'm offended that you don't like the exact same thing that I like, and vice versa, right? The critics like, well, you're dumb, because that is a bad movie. Mm-hmm. And we all get in an argument when, in fact, it's cilantro, where, like, hey, it tastes like soap to one person and is amazingly spicy to another. Who cares?
But here's the point, Tom. We're all in a game, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter at the end of the day.
But, you know, for me, you said you found someone that whose tastes were similar to yours. I actually, this is where I'm going to be kind of screwed by SF Signal being gone, because Derek He hated everything. So I always knew what to go see. Whatever he hated, I knew I was going to love.
There was a guy like that in San Francisco Chronicle in the early part of the 2000s. I'm like, if he doesn't like it, I know I'm going to love it.
Oh, exactly. See, that's great. Yeah. I mean, when Ebert was around, I generally agreed with Ebert on many of his picks. And then once in a while, he'd find something that either he thought was great and I was just like, what did you see in that thing? Or he'd hate something that I totally loved. And I don't know that there's a way to find somebody who's going to be perfect for that every time. So the bottom line is just go with your gut, man. Go see it because it's Warcraft. There's orcs and like humans and stuff fighting like a video game. That's a good time for everybody unless you're some uppity wiener who doesn't play video games. So he shouldn't see it, but the rest of us should go see it. All right? All right.
Yep, for the horde.
Thank you for your email, Karen. Emails at us, come to us, at us, at currentgeek@gmail.com. Please keep them coming, and we're really glad when those come in. It's going to do it for the show. Huge thanks to our guests. John, let's start with you, and why don't you tell us more about the podcast and where people can find your fine work, sir?
Oh, well, the podcast that Patrick and I do every week, it's called Functional Nerds, and we've been doing it for a long time, 6-7 years, something like that, and most of the time we have a science fiction or fantasy author. You venture out to other places too, other kind of creative folks. But that's kind of our bread and butter. And we've interviewed just about everybody this side of George R. R. Martin and Neil Gaiman. So we've had Brandon Sanderson, we've had Timothy Zahn, Kevin J. Anderson, Gail Carriger, Ann Leckie, a lot.
Tom Merritt.
Yeah.
He's going to be on the next show. So if you go search Functional Nerds in iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, Tom's episode will drop on Tuesday.
So don't judge their show by the next guest. All right. They have much better guests.
I hear there's a brand new book out called Pilot X. That's really fantastic.
And we talk a lot about how Tom is putting that together with Inkshares. And so if you are interested in hearing a little bit deeper about that process, go and check that episode out when it drops. And that's what Patrick and I do together. Music, I just want to mention this one thing real quick because it does tie into, we were talking earlier about when I performed at Nerdtacular, and I haven't been doing a lot of performing lately, but I have been doing a lot of instrumental work for audiobooks and different kind of multimedia things. And I actually just recently scored a short film called Toppled, which is directed by Paul DeNigris, who I think you guys know Paul because I met him at Nerdtacular.
He was at the UAT, the guy that taught at the University of Arizona Technical, whatever the heck it was. That's cool. Yes. I didn't know he was working on a movie. That's awesome.
Yeah, so he and I got to be friends because he was doing all the video and the sound work when I played there, and you know, we've kind of kept in touch, and I've done a couple other little projects for him, but this is a really cool 12-minute movie. I'm not sure when it's coming out, but it stars Tony Amendola, which if you are a Stargate fan, that is Braytek on Stargate. He's the star of this movie. He's also in Continuum. But it's a great 12-minute movie, and I was really excited to do the musical score for it.
So super cool. Keep
that's what I got going on musically.
That's awesome.
That's it.
All right. Well, thanks, man. Hey, Patrick, anything else from you, sir?
Well, in addition to Functional Nerds, for many, many years, I was part of sfsignal.com. I did the podcast there, went to Hugo's for working for SF Signal and for doing that podcast. Even though the site's gone, there's still an archive of the episodes. There's over 300. So if you are interested in interviews with science fiction people and convention type panels, you can still go out there and listen to those. There's a ton of those out there. I've got fiction available on Amazon under my name, and here in the next couple of months I'll have a book called Into the Fire that's being released by Wordfire Press, and I already have the cover. I showed it to Tom, and he geeked out over it because it's pretty cool.
Good. That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
Man, look at you guys.
I should mention that Wordfire Press is run by Kevin J. Anderson. So that's he's done and his wife as well. And so that, if that name sounds familiar, Kevin J. Anderson wrote a lot of the early Star Wars books after Zahn. So he wrote like the Jedi Academy trilogy, which are no longer canon, but they're still good books. Mm-hmm. and he's done a lot of other stuff. He's done the Dune books and lots of his own properties too. And
he has 120 books out.
Yeah. That sounds about right for Kevin.
That's J. a lot. Yeah. Holy crap.
And he's friends with Neil Peart, the drummer.
Yeah, and so they.
I love Neil Peart. Is he Canadian too?
I don't think Kevin is, but yeah. I think Kevin and Neil have been friends for a long time, and there's a couple of Rush songs that are inspired by Kevin's short stories, and then the most recent Rush album, Clockwork Angels, Kevin wrote the Neil Peart came up with the story, and Kevin J. Anderson wrote the novelization of the story, so there's like a real connection.
He recently gave a speech that I was there for, where he talked about building that relationship. Essentially, I think his first book was inspired by one of Rush's albums, and somehow it found its way. I forget how, but it found its way into Neil Peart's hands, who recognized it. And that kind of struck up the friendship between the two of them. Cool. And so they've worked together for years and years and years on stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Neil Peart still the best.
And they're publishing my first book, Wordfire.
Yeah. Woo. Yeah.
Well, congratulations to everybody. Everyone's got a book. I'm making a coloring book.
You've got a book.
I really, well,
I
true.
Own your book.
That's true. I do have a book, and it's still some available at frogpants.com/store. It's a bunch of comics, but I am actually working on a coloring book for adults. So watch for that. And by adults, I don't mean there's wieners in it. Okay, everybody.
It's not Game of Thrones.
No, it's not Game of Thrones. Game of Wieners. All right. Well, thank you both for being here. I had a great time. As always, thank you everybody for listening at home. If you want to catch more of the show or find more links and find more stuff, go to currentgeek.com. You can call us, leave us voicemails, 801-471-0462. Current Geek, Scott Johnson, and Ace Detect on Twitter, and currentgeek@gmail.com. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and our guests. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we take a look at a recent court decision which confirms how difficult it can be to patent some board and card game designs in the current patent climate in the U.S., and what the options are for creative game developers. Amanda and Ray Smith developed and tried to patent a new method of playing blackjack, consisting of new rules mixed in with those well-known for this gambling card game. The claims focused on implementing these game rules with physical playing cards, and these were rejected by the U.S. Patent Office for not being eligible patentable subject matter, according to rules clarified a couple years ago in the Supreme Court's Alice Corp v. CLS Bank decision. That decision primarily focused on software, but it's had a broad reach. A few weeks ago, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the decision of the Patent Office and its appeal board to reject these claims on playing a card game as patent ineligible. What made this case interesting beyond the card game field was that this is the first time the appeals court confirmed that it will not pass judgment on the Patent Office's suggested subject matter eligibility guidelines, which are published to help explain the standards to lawyers and to patent examiners following the decision in Alice. This guidance is not actual rules promulgated by the Patent Office, and thus the court does not consider them binding enough to provide any judgment. Turning this back towards our favorite field of card games, does this signal the end of patents for game rules? Not necessarily. The Federal Circuit explicitly acknowledged that some inventions in games could still meet the requirement of being something substantially more than just an abstract idea under the test set forth in the Alice decision. An example provided for card games would be those for conducting a game with a newly developed original deck of cards. Another good sign is that the Smiths also had claims in their patent for performing the same game rules using a video game system, like a software app, and those were deemed allowable and patent eligible. As many board and card games move to parallel release as apps and physical products, this means patent protection is still likely available for part of those ideas. Plus, design patents can be used to cover very broad aspects of graphical user interfaces, which may be used with video games, so there's a lot of protection still on the table for game designers. However, the Smith decision this year simply confirms that some tabletop game designs will simply fall victim to the rules becoming harsher across the board against method claims and software type claims in U.S. patents. The bottom line is, it's always been tough to patent game rules, and that is not changing anytime soon. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this segment, we'll be coming to Origins Game Fair in Columbus, Ohio in June. Please message me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy, and we can meet up. I'm also giving two seminars about game design and the law. Feel free to check those out.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com. We'll be right back.